Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Another one of the fascinating speakers that we have invited to the campus this semester is Dr. Conrad Crane, who became the director of the U.S. Army Military History Institute on February 1, 2003. Prior to that, he served with the Strategic Studies Institute at the U.S. Army War College from September 2000 to January 2003. He held the General Douglas MacArthur Chair of Research there. Dr. Crane holds a B.S. from the U.S. Military Academy and an M.A. and a Ph.D. from Stanford University, and he's going to be speaking on November the 2nd at MTSU. He joins us now via telephone to talk about, in general terms, his topic, which will be the development and application of the new counterinsurgency doctrine. And welcome, Dr. Crane. Appreciate you being with us today.
Hey, I appreciate being invited.
Can you explain to us, first of all, just to lay the groundwork, what was the prior counterinsurgency doctrine and how has it changed?
Well, after Vietnam, there's a reaction against counterinsurgency in the American military as well as American political leadership, and there's kind of a sense that we're not going to fight those kind of wars again. Rather than learn how to fight them better, the sense is, well, we're just going to figure out how to avoid them. And it's really not until the 1980s that there's any interest that returns in counterinsurgency because of El Salvador and Nicaragua. But even then, it's a very low level of military involvement. 55 advisors, I think, we were limited to in El Salvador. So the major conventional forces just don't get interested in counterinsurgency. And that's really, when we go into Iraq in 2003, there is counterinsurgency doctrine out there, but it's basically for a small group of advisors or special forces soldiers doing all the hard work with mostly indigenous personnel and American money as well. And what happens is in after the insurgency explodes in Iraq and some of the things that start to happen in Afghanistan, there's a realization that the military needs to relook at how it's going to approach counterinsurgency. And there are two very capable individuals that come out of Iraq in 2005, Lieutenant General David Petraeus for the Army, Lieutenant General James Mattis for the Marine Corps, who are both assigned to posts within their services where they can change the way their organizations do training and doctrine and education, and both decide that it's time to change the way their organizations think, to make the Army and the Marine Corps better learning organizations, because that's what it's going to take to fight the kind of wars that we are facing today. And so both of them institute a number of programs to transform their services, and one of those is the development of a new doctrine, a new guidelines for fighting counterinsurgency.
Does this apply regardless of whether the action is unilateral, as Iraq essentially was, talk of a coalition notwithstanding,
yes,
or when we were acting in true concert with real partners?
No, it's the doctrine recognizes that there's a lot of different partners out there that have to be involved in this. And you have to be one of the first steps in figuring out how you're going to approach any of these operations is figuring out exactly who the heck you're working with. You're going to have indigenous players, you're going to have international players, you're going to have non-governmental players, you'll have other agencies of the U.S. government involved. And you've got to kind of figure out who they are, and they've all got a role to play. One of the things about these kinds of wars, these wars among the people, the counterinsurgency, the stability operations we're involved in, is the military cannot succeed by themselves. You need a lot of involvement from other civilian agencies and a lot of involvement from indigenous organizations, indigenous forces. If you have coalition partners, that's good, that helps, but that also makes it more complicated. One of the things that has made Afghanistan so complex is just trying to get the various partners, especially NATO, to conform to the new doctrine, conform to a uniform counterinsurgency campaign. You've got to have some kind of unity of effort in these kinds of operations, and it's very difficult because very rarely do you have actual command over these other organizations. I mean, even the civilian organizations have got to be on the same sheet of music, and it creates a very complicated command and control system based on, in many cases, a lot of handshakes and personal relationships.
What if you're dealing with a government, such as the case in Afghanistan, that is supposed to be your partner, but essentially you cannot trust? I'm talking about the regime of Hamid Karzai.
One of the eternal problems in doing counterinsurgency is trying to get those you are helping to do exactly what you think they need to do to be successful. We had the problem in Vietnam. We had the problem in Korea, Thailand, Greece. You can go back to any of our advisory efforts on counterinsurgency. You always have difficulties getting the people you're helping to do what you think are necessary actions. Now, there's two sides of this, however. One is that you know, we can talk about, there's a lot of news stories out there about the corruption of the Karzai government and some of the problems there. But on the other side, there also is an historical record that shows that oftentimes people on the ground have a better idea what's necessary to be successful than we do. And so there's a balance there. And one of the things that led to a lot of our success in Iraq was we learned to accept local solutions to problems instead of trying to impose our own. Now, with that said, there are some things that you can't allow to stand. If you, for instance, if there are abusive security forces that are basically recruiters for the insurgency, if you have an extreme level of corruption in government that makes it impossible for it to be seen as legitimate by the people, that can't be allowed to stand. Because the success in these kind of wars depends very much on the support of the population. And it's the key goal is legitimacy and setting up some kind of legitimate authority that the people accept. You still have to go out and kill the bad guys and capture the bad guys. But long-term success comes from popular support and some kind of authority that the population will support and maintain.
Does the new doctrine lay out any other criteria for helping leaders determine when it would and would not be prudent to engage in counterinsurgency?
Actually, there was another document done as a spinoff of our doctrine that talks about that. Our doctrine is an operation-level doctrine that tells military commanders, here's how you conduct a counterinsurgency campaign and be successful. So the assumption of the doctrine that we did is that the decision to engage in counterinsurgency has already been made. Now, as a spinoff of this effort, there was about a three-year effort done by the interagency. Actually, I guess the final version was written by David Kilcullen, who was at that point working for the Department of State. That is an interagency counterinsurgency guide, which talks about, presents guidelines for government decision makers to determine whether counterinsurgency is to be conducted or not. Personally, I find it very much flawed, but it was a start. The drawback of it, though, is it was completed in December 2009, or December 2008, and it was signed by the Bush administration and has never really, to my understanding, been adopted by the Obama administration.
One of the criticisms of the way we handled Iraq was that after shock and awe, the Baathists were by and large purged, and although they were loyalist of Saddam Hussein, so the argument goes, they might have been of some use because they had knowledge that we could have found useful. How do you feel about that critique?
Well, I think, too, my personal opinion, and this is not the official view, but my personal opinion is that both the disbanding of the Iraqi army and the depth of debathification were major mistakes. They went too far. The army was one of the key unifying elements within the society. Disbanding that was a real mistake. The debathification, you had to remove some of the senior leaders, but debathification really went too deep and removed too many of the mid-level technocrats who kind of ran the society. And one of the things that has been improving in Iraq is they've passed some laws to set up rules to allow the Baathists to get kind of back into society and into the administration. There's been more of a work to kind of reorganize and rebuild those structures. more reconciliation with the Baathists, and that's been part of the improvements in Iraq, was figuring out how to get those Baathists kind of back into things. It was done mostly with the Iraqis did it themselves with their own rules and their own ways to do it. But that is a necessary part of the rebuilding of Iraq, has to be to get those people into the system. It not only did they have expertise that would help, but also it removes them from the insurgency.
Another critique that comes from the civilians is that we, the United States, should not get involved in another country's civil war. It's their business, and the interests of the United States are not served by that. Well, an insurgency, a civil war is by definition an insurgency, but not all insurgencies are civil wars, correct?
Well, all insurgencies contain at least some elements of civil war. I mean, if you look at the political science definition for internal war, which is insurgency and counterinsurgency or internal war and civil war, the definition are almost exactly the same. So there are always elements of civil war in insurgencies. It is the amount of sectarian violence, though, does shape your tactics. One of the worst things you can do in a situation where there is very, very violent sectarian strife is to hold early elections, because all it does is lock in the divisions or try to set up security forces indigenous security forces too early, because it basically locks in along these sectarian lines. So you've got to have some finesse in the way you do that. It does change the way you deal with them, depending on the levels of sectarian division and strife. But that is always an element of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and it's something you've got to understand and know how to deal with.
You've said that there are two kinds of warfare, asymmetrical and stupid. I tend to think, or have thought before speaking to you, that asymmetrical warfare as opposed to conventional warfare is determined by who your opponent is, by these loose-knit networks of terrorist organizations rather than geopolitical nation states with defined borders, like as was the case in World War II, for example. But you define asymmetrical warfare as about the tactics, it seems to me, rather than about who you're fighting.
Right. Basically, if you look at warfare, a better way maybe to divide it up would be conventional and irregular, I guess, for the way the tactics are fought. Everybody tries to fight asymmetrical. I mean, we fight asymmetric too. We do it with technology. We do it with air power. We do it with large forces. Overwhelming force is a form of asymmetric warfare. No commander tries to fight exactly the same as somebody else unless they're really stupid. That's why it's the asymmetric and stupid is the way that I characterize warfare. But irregular war is different from conventional war. People fight differently. Even non-state actors fight conventionally sometimes. It's one of the surprises that Hezbollah sprung against the Israelis in Lebanon, was they fought very conventionally in some places, and the Israelis did not really expect that. So, you're right. Conventional warfare, irregular warfare, really deals with the ways, the tactics that people fight. You're right that opponents today are very different. Even insurgencies today are very different. In Vietnam, the insurgency was a centrally directed insurgency that was run by the North Vietnamese Politburo. Whether it was the Viet Cong in the south or whether it was the North Vietnamese Army, they were controlled centrally by this one organization. Today, the insurgency or insurgencies we're up against are loose networks of all kinds of organizations that may have very different objectives. They use very different tactics and approaches. The network shift, one of the successes we had in Iraq was being able to break these networks apart and get parts of them to come over to our side, which is really kind of always happens in insurgency and counterinsurgency. People always turn. But one of the things you have to master in modern counterinsurgency is figuring out what these networks are, who you can talk to, who you have to kill, how you can turn one part against the other part. One of the key things about the awakening in Anbar province in Iraq was we're able to take a Sunni tribal insurgency, get it on our side, and use it to start killing the foreign fighters that were Al-Qaeda. So it's a very complex situation out there. It takes a lot of complex analysis to understand exactly who your enemies are and what they're trying to do. And each enemy in this network may take a different approach. So it's a very, very complex campaign that results.
Given the topography of Afghanistan and the climate and all the political complications, is Afghanistan a conflict that is even winnable?
Well, part of it, again, this is my own personal viewpoint. Part of it, it depends upon what are your definitions of winning. We're not going to turn Afghanistan into a thriving democracy, in my view, soon, if ever. You should be able to maintain some kind of stability there, though, or at least keep Al-Qaeda from reestablishing itself. So, you know, winning depends on what are your conditions of what are your conditions of victory? What are your conditions of success? Victory may be a term that becomes irrelevant as well. A lot of people are very pessimistic about Afghanistan, but at the same time, there's a realization that there's no way that the Taliban's not winning either, and there's no way that the Taliban can be successful as long as we maintain a presence there. The question is whether we have the will to stick it out as long as it's going to take. Whatever ends up in Afghanistan is, in my view, again, this is a personal viewpoint, that is going to be, I think the Taliban or elements of the Taliban will be involved. Very rarely do insurgencies and counterinsurgencies end with a very clear one side wins everything, one side loses everything. There's normally some kind of a compromise in the middle ground result. I'm confident that we can attain some kind of result in Afghanistan that will keep Al-Qaeda from reestablishing itself there. But it'll be a very messy result. There's still going to be a level of violence. There's still going to be corruption there. The central government is not going to be very strong. The determination of what the result is based upon what you set for how high you set the bar. I think if those of us have expected to go into Afghanistan and create a thriving democracy and a thriving Western-style market economy, set the bar way, way too high. We're not going to get that, but I think we can obtain a solution where, again, Al-Qaeda cannot establish itself again. But it's going to be a messy. And by the way, Pakistan's also important. You're not going to solve the problem in Afghanistan unless you also involve Pakistan and solve some of the problems in northwest Pakistan as well. So Afghanistan and Pakistan are linked.
You anticipated my next question because it was going to be about the Obama administration's including Afghanistan and Pakistan as sort of conjoined twins under Richard Holbrooke's purview. How do you think that has worked so far?
Well, you've got to do it that way. I mean, you cannot. In fact, you've got to link Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, to be honest, because India also has major influence on what Pakistan is trying to do, and we can be very critical of Pakistan for not putting more emphasis into its own counterinsurgency fight in the northwest frontier, but they've still got major concerns about India on the other side of the country. So you've got to look at that whole region. I know that General Petraeus has done a lot of dealings with the Pakistanis as well as the Afghans. It's funny, if you talk to the Afghans will say, well, if you guys just fix the problems in Pakistan, we'll be fine. If you talk to the Pakistanis, they'll say, if you just fix the problems in Afghanistan, we'll be fine. In reality, it's a mutual problem that will require solutions on both sides of the Afghan-Pakistan border.
Let's talk about some of the hot spots, trouble locations around the world for just a second. This is away from the counterinsurgency topic, I know, but how would you assess, from what you understand, or what is your understanding of the extent of Iran's progress in their nuclear program?
Well, I'm not privy to any intelligence that any more than anyone else is what they're reading the newspapers. I do know that Iran has been a problem in Iraq. And of course, they also have been a problem with Hezbollah and some of the other groups that they fund. So on the regular side, they've been they've been assisting a lot of our enemies. I'm not privy to any more intelligence than anybody else about what's going on in their nuclear program, but it bothers me the same as it does everybody else, and I'm not sure exactly what the actions will be taken to deal with it. But if it's military action, the repercussions of that could have all kinds of ripples. I mean, it's a tense situation that I hope that everyone involved in taking actions against it will think very carefully about the consequences of all their actions.
Let's talk a little bit about what you might say to some of the young people who are in military classes or in ROTC here at Middle Tennessee State University when you come. What do you want the young person studying the art of warfare to know first and foremost?
That's a very, very good question. And I think that the theme of the new doctrine is learn and adapt. You've got to be able to learn and adapt faster than your enemies do. And it's, you can, Mike, a very smart, a very brilliant military historian, Michael Howard, once said that the purpose of military doctrine is not to be too far wrong, that to at least get people close enough so they can make the right adjustments when they get under fire to come up with something that will work. And I think that's kind of what we've come up with our doctrine. But the key thing is it's got to be adjusted for each individual situation. This is a mosaic war. It's very difficult for anyone to grasp what's going on in places like Afghanistan overall because the war changes from village to village, valley to valley. The responsibility for understanding the situation and applying the right solutions evolves very low down in the chain of command. Especially in this kind of war, and so these young men and women who are in military classes or thinking about going into the military and leading troops in combat, they've got to understand that there'll be a lot of responsibility on their shoulders, and it's not just to know the military tactics and techniques. They're going to have to master the cultural aspects of the society they're in. They're going to have to understand what makes those people think, what makes them tick, what legitimacy is to them. They have to understand the dynamics of the situation they're in, the economics, the governance. Modern warfare is not just about killing people and breaking things anymore. It's about restoring essential services, establishing good governance, creating a vibrant economy, building up host nation security forces and host nation institutions that can sustain success on their own. It's much more complex than war was when I came into the Army in the 1970s, and we knew that our enemy was the Soviet hordes coming over the hill, and if we could just destroy them, we would win. It's just not that simple anymore.
I heard a package on a public radio station not too long ago with interviews with some young men from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, who were in the military, in the Army, and they had just gotten back from a tour of duty. And their complaint, if you will, or their observation, was that they had been trained to be warriors, but they were having difficulty balancing the hearts and minds aspect of today's military service abroad with the necessity of it engaging in conflict. And they found those two ideas diametrically opposed to one another. I'm putting it a little bit more in a little bit more complicated fashion than they did, but basically they thought, I'm trained to fight, I ought to go out there and fight. So how does the modern soldier deal with this yin and yang?
Well, okay, it's a good question. Again, though, I'll say that we didn't use the term hearts and minds in the doctrine because there are other parts of the anatomy you can grab to make people go along with you.
Quite
well,
true.
Hearts and minds. And there, coercion is a part of this as well. It's not all. It's carrots and sticks. And the combat aspect is still necessary as part of the sticks that sometimes take to get proper action. You're correct, though, that it is a tough fight. I was amazed in Iraq when I was talking with soldiers, and they talked about learning to turn the switch on and off is the way way they phrased it. And what that meant was that basically you had to know when to be prepared to talk and when to be prepared to fight. And they were so adept at it. I mean, this is the greatest counterinsurgency force the world's ever seen. I could say it's because of our doctrine, but it's because everybody's been to Iraq and Afghanistan 3 and 4 times, and they've learned it through experience. Most soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines have been able to adapt to this multi-level kind of engagement. They'd be able to fight and then turn around and talk to people and one day you're doing a combat patrol, the next day you're doing humanitarian assistance. Most of them that I've seen have thrived in it. Some have had trouble with it. And not saying that it's been everything's been roses. They've been very rosy, but it's a leadership challenge that I think the military has done very well with. The American people should be very, very proud of their services and the way that everyone has responded to this. But it is a tough problem. There's a big debate within all the service, especially the Army today, about have we gone too far down this irregular warfare road? Are we becoming too soft? Are we losing a lot of the conventional skills that make us so formidable? Are we losing the ability to do large mass maneuver of major combat forces because everything is more small unit engagement these days? Are we losing the ability to do mass artillery fires? There are concerns about losing some of those very, very high-end conventional skills, and it's a tough debate. I mean, Secretary Gates has said we've got to win the wars we're in now. I know General Casey is very concerned about the wars down the road and how we can maintain the conventional skills to fight somebody like, say, North Korea or Iran if they're going to use major conventional forces. It's a real challenge for strategists, resource managers, theorists. It pulls our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines a lot of different directions. But like I said, I've been very, very, very pleased with the way that the bulk, the large majority of our combat forces have responded on the ground. They've shown the ability to do this, and I mean, it's a tribute to the all-volunteer force that they've been able to multitask so well on these very, very different levels and very different missions that are required in this kind of war.
Is there an analogy to be made with Vietnam in that the soldiers in that conflict, American soldiers in that conflict, did not always know or could not always tell which civilians were cooperating with the Viet Cong and which were just innocent victims of the whole mess?
And that is a continuous problem in this kind of warfare. I mean, the enemy immerses themselves among the people. Trying to figure out who is on your side and who is not is still difficult. And again, victory is determined by achieving popular support. You're trying to change people's attitudes, and attitudes are very hard to measure. This is not something you kind of go out with you can't kind of count people's attitudes. You've got to. A lot of it is gut feel. A lot of it is polling. A lot of it is watching people's actions. Do they go to the market? Do they send their kids to school again? It's very difficult to judge, and it takes a lot of cultural skills, language skills. It's a very, very complex kind of warfare, and it's I just think it's a real tribute to the all-volunteer force we have that they've been able to do as well as they have.
In the brief time we have left, I'm going to utter those four dirty little words, and if you don't want to comment on them, you don't have to, I understand, but I feel compelled to bring it up because of current events. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah, that's one that's good. All I can say on that one is whatever the politicians, whatever the civilian political leaders decide, the military will execute it without question and to the, you know, and to 100%. I mean, they'll follow orders. There are strong opinions on both sides out there. But the military, all I can say from my own experience, what I know about the military, the people I've talked to, is they are prepared to execute whatever orders they are given.
Thank you, Dr. Conrad Crane, who will be speaking here at Middle Tennessee State University on November 2nd. For more information, contact the College of Liberal Arts or Dr. Robert Hunt in the Department of History. Dr. Crane, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Me too. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're available on iTunes.